I can't change the way my mother felt about me and admitting that she just hated me. I can't change the way my father felt about me. I can't change the way they almost killed me a million times. And I can't change the way that I felt about wanting to not be present. And in my book, I do detail about, you know, taking my life or just the pressure. And now, thanks to the producers, House of Hammer will remind me of everything I've endured to be sitting here as a survivor, as a whole person. It's starting a conversation that bad behavior is not okay, and you have a choice, and you should be free to speak out without repercussions or threats on your life, just in general.
We always give you our all when you fly with Southwest. Low fares, so you can visit family on another island or go on vacation to the mainland. No change or cancel fees because life happens. And bags fly free, so you can always pack all you need. Start worrying less and enjoying more. All for you. Book today at southwest.com. Fare difference may apply. Failure to cancel a reservation at least 10 minutes prior to scheduled departure may result in forfeited travel funds. First and second check bags. Weight and size limits apply.
Hello, this is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer, producer of CBS Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and host of the podcast Crime Analyst.
And I'm Lisa Zambelli. I'm a casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, and we're continuing our discussion of many things that are under the umbrella of House of Hammer, which is a Discovery Plus docuseries. We're also shining a light on Casey Hammer, who is Armie Hammer's aunt, and her very vulnerable book, Surviving My Birthright. And so let's just jump right back into it.
Casey writes in her book that even after seeing all the abuse that her father rained down on her mother, she still adored him. She was so attached to him. Even after they fled him and were living in another state, she longed to jump on a plane and go back to him, and she did. And of course, he ignored her and put her in all kinds of horrific situations that no 12-year-old girl should ever be seeing. But that's common, right? You attach to the person even though they've treated you like garbage.
Yeah, it's called ambivalence, and they have strong feelings. Typically, people who are victimized will have, especially children, will have strong ambivalent feelings, which means they have equally weighty feelings, good and bad, about the person. They're suffering through horrible things from that person, but they want the love of this person. And so they think it's their lot in life. They think they deserve it. They think they blame themselves because they're children and their psyches have not yet developed to be able to understand, to look outside of their own existence and see what's actually going on. But the fact is that everybody wants to be loved by their parent. Everybody wants a close relationship with them. They want their parents to be perfect. They want their parents to be wonderful. And some people are fortunate enough to have that. But many people are in a situation where their parents are not treating them properly. They're not taking care of them as children. And in fact, in this case, Casey describes horrific behavior. Like you said, not just doing bad things to her and exposing her to incredibly nasty things, that sexualizing a child at a very early age, obviously all this stuff is going to have a tremendous impact on her and her psyche and her future. So I hope, you know, that it was cathartic and therapeutic writing this book. And I hope that now she has found some peace, but damn, she was definitely taken advantage of and brutally abused by a brutal person who headed a brutal family, who basically encouraged the males in the family to be brutal. And it's no wonder that Armie Hammer would think that it's okay to do some of these things.
And also, just to pick up on what Jim said, you know, it's very conflicting for a child. And that conflict that Jim talked about, because you do want this unconditional love. And as a child, you don't know any different. So you just think that you're doing things wrong. And if only you do X and Y, then you'll be loved or you'll be cared for. But to be abandoned and neglected, you know, the emotional side to that is it results in complex PTS, complex post-traumatic stress, when it's ongoing. And it's by the people who you're supposed to be cared for and nurtured by and loved, then it's far more severe and long-term, actually, the post-traumatic stress. So that's why it's even more damaging in trust relationships. And those trust relationships as a child to a parent. And then you've got parents who've been abused themselves, and then they may have entitled trauma and they hand down. You know, maybe they react and they're quick to react, or they're defensive themselves, but they're emotionally dysregulated. And then what you see is the children are emotionally dysregulated. This is where you get the intergenerational cycle. And that's what Casey, I listened to her on one interview with Tamron Hall, where she said specifically she wants to interrupt that cycle. And that's what we've talked about before on Real Crime Profile, that this cycle that happens because you've got generation after generation behaving in the same way, and it's so damaging for the children. And she's worried for Armie Hammer's two children. You know, there it's the next generation, that if you are not wholesome in your interactions and your behavior, then that does have an impact on the next generation. So it's not easy stuff. The first is recognizing that you've been victimized. And the second is, well, what are you going to do about it? So Casey found a way of writing this book, which, as you said, Lisa, no one really picked up on it. It was self-published until now, when this docu-series has come out. And so for her, just speaking her truth, that can be tremendously healing. That's why a lot of clients who come to me or would come to Paladin, they'd say things like, just you listening has really helped, because just voicing what's gone on, that's a power in itself.
Yeah, can we speak about that line, though? Speaking her truth. I mean, there is a truth. There is something that happened. There can be, people's interpretation can be different. But when a father engages in any sexual activity with a daughter, it's always sexual abuse. When a brother, older brother, engages in sexual activity with the sister, it's always abuse. No matter what your experience was at the time, legally, it is abuse. So it is the truth, not just a truth or a person's truth. It is the truth that what she describes is sexual victimization of a child, period. And I don't care what her brother or her father or her grandfather or anybody thought about what was going on, it's still a crime. And nobody can sugarcoat that.
Yeah. And those crimes can be normalized. And I think that exposure, when it's constantly around you, that's what happens. It becomes normalized. And I think that's why Casey's book is quite jarring. You know, the honesty and just the moving from one sex act to another and just being so candid with it, that talks to authenticity. Because for her, it was just her upbringing. And as children, we don't know any different. We just are born into whatever situation we find ourselves, and we try and cope with and do the best that we can. And that's also the emotional dysregulation, is that your emotional maturity can be interrupted. So you can become emotionally immature and remain that age when you were abused. So what I will say, there's a huge amount of positives of people who have been on their healing journey, that there is life after abuse and life can be good again, but you have to go to dark places first of all in order to identify it, to look it in the face, certainly to know that it wasn't your fault, it wasn't anything that you did. And just going back to what you said, Jim, you know, whether it's a father or a stepfather in particular, stepfathers on stepdaughters, I see that a lot in cases. And of course, we've talked about a very high profile case where things can be normed because they're not a blood father, and therefore they start sexually interacting with their 15-year-old stepdaughter, and somehow that gets normed, which, again, that norming and other people buying into it is incredibly conflicting and confusing for a child who might believe that that attention is quite flattering, that that is a normal level of attention from a stepfather or a father. So it's very conflicting emotionally and psychologically. I really think Casey speaking out, you know, she's a huge voice in this documentary, and it must be validating for her in some ways that other people have spoken out about the family, because there's been no accountability thus far. That what she learned was that because her family were rich and privileged, they were above the law. And Jim, we've talked about that before, when people think they're above the law and the rules and the laws don't apply to them. Right? They apply to everybody else, but not to them.
Yeah, well, clearly it's not true, but they act that way. And for many, they actually get away with it. I mean, you know, the Jimmy Savilles in the UK, the Bill Cosbys in the US. I mean, because they enjoyed such a, you know, well, a positive public image and connections with the people in the highest stations around the world, they were literally able to, for, you know, for many decades, they were able to take advantage of people, you know, unrestrained.
Yes. And talking about Jimmy Savile, we saw Princess Diana and Prince Charles, who's now King Charles, within Jimmy Savile's sort of social
orbit. Yeah.
Yeah, orbit, right? Which validates him and empowers him. But also Prince, now King Charles, makes an appearance in this docuseries, right? With Dr. Armin Hammer, the grandfather, who also found favor with the royal family. And that had a huge impact, particularly when we're going to come on to Piper Alpha in particular, the oil rig. But certainly royal family, well, they've been in the news a lot, not just because of the Queen dying, but because of Prince Andrew, you know, and who he gravitated to, the Epsteins, et cetera, and that level and layer of protection that it seems to give individuals who seek them out. I believe they seek them out because it gives them that extra layer of protection. And many who set up charities, you know, so you can't possibly be an abuser if you've got this charity, right? Mm. I mean, it's all a front that I feel is cleverly and craftily used and manipulated. And I do think this family in particular, Dr. Armin Hammer, the grandfather, and even before him, there's a whole line of men who have been behaving in a way with a lack of accountability. Even when Julian, it was believed that he killed another man just over a gambling debt. He kills a man, and then Dr. Armin Hammer, his father intervenes and pays off the judge. How can that be right?
I mean, that's a crime. It's a crime. Oh, but because he had the money, he got away with it.
Yeah, this part of the documentary was really fascinating to me, and it's corroborated by New York Times reporting and also Julie Miller's deep dive article in Vanity Fair. But the crimes that they allege against, I don't mean to laugh in humor, it's just absurd. The crimes against Armin Hammer include money laundering, bribes, funding Soviet espionage, paying off for a Watergate cover-up, a felony obstruction that was pardoned by a president. And as Laura mentioned, the Piper Alpha disaster in 1988, where 160 workers were killed on an oil rig off the coast of Aberdeen, Scotland, as reported that it's because of inadequate maintenance and safety procedures, and they never paid any consequence. In fact, in the documentary, it shows Dr. Hammer and his wife actually getting sympathy, as though this horrible accident had happened to them. If you had to write this, you'd be laughed out of a writer's room, because it just seems too crazy to believe that this could really happen.
And he should be arrested for coercive control. But back to Piper Alpha. I mean, I remember this in my childhood. Yeah. I remember it being on the TV. I mean, it was the 6th of July, 1988. It was 167 people who were killed. 30 bodies were never recovered. Only 61 survived. It's the worst disaster that's happened ever in history. And this rig produced 3,000 barrels of oil daily. And there was basically a basic safety maintenance issue that they didn't bother to check the valves. And gas started leaking from a pipe, which was missing a safety valve. And it took weeks to get that fire under control. The sea was actually on fire.
Wow.
You know, so it was just, it's something that's in my memory as a child of seeing it and witnessing it. And the inquiry into the rig's operation did find that Occidental Petroleum had used inadequate safety procedures. And they did pay some money in compensation. And there was a Piper Alpha Families and Survivors Association that was set up. What was incredible to me in the docuseries was seeing that connection back to Dr. Armin Hammer and his reaction to it, that he went there, he did a speech, Prince Charles, now King Charles, kind of got him out the shit. And then he gets back on a plane announcing, get the champagne and caviar ready. It's been a successful day. After listening to all those victims, all those men who had been killed, and many men who were scarred psychologically from rescuing other men, from putting them into the hospitals with burns that were so horrific. And this man comes back and it's his responsibility, and that's his reaction, to open the champagne and get the caviar out. I mean, that just, in the pit of my stomach, I felt absolutely sick to hear that was his reaction. And he never once visited any of the families, any of the survivors, not once.
Yeah, what a slime bag, a complete and utter slime bag. And to be capable of celebrating on that day, I mean, it just reminds me of, you know, Catholic Church lawyers high-fiving when they get somebody to sign a non-disclosure agreement and get them to settle a case, as opposed to being, you know, brought out in the public. That's something to celebrate. Something to celebrate that a priest sexually victimized, raped kids. I mean, come on. It is exactly the kind of same kind of personality, and it's despicable.
But that tells us, Jim and Lisa, who he was, right? Just in that moment, that's who Casey was facing. That's who her mother was facing, a man who, by his own press officer or his press advisor, said that he is the embodiment of sin and ruthless evil. That was someone on the inside who worked for him saying that. Now, that's the way he's characterized by Angela, his former wife. He was married 3 times. This man sounds to me, I mean, I was listening to it all, and Jim and I, you and I tend to do this at a subconscious level. You tick through the psychopathy traits, right? And he seems to be coming out and scoring high. To have that lack of responsibility taking, lack of remorse, lack of empathy, lack of care, and just to see it as a success that he wasn't in the shit and that he'd escaped that, rather than feel for 167 men who died an incredibly painful death, probably most of them, unless they were killed instantly in one of the multiple explosions. But that told me everything about him. We're not just talking about somebody who was just bad. He did these things consciously, and it was strategy and planned and tactics. And so the next generation, and it's not to excuse, but the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And unless you really want to change those behaviors, you know, so Casey really has opened Pandora's box, and she describes it as that, of shining a light. But for me, that Piper Alpha, the absolute disaster, which was completely preventable in 1988, seeing that track back to him, wow, it shocked me and surprised me, because there seemed to be no real accountability to it. The way the media portrayed it is it was just some kind of accident.
Right.
A tragedy that happened. Just awful. So many people put at risk from basic safety checks not being done. So that really does paint the picture of Dr. Armin Hammer, and the fact that he's the master of bribery, as you said, Lisa, some of the allegations and charges, he just had no shame, and he just felt the rules didn't apply to him. And that was with people, whether you are female or male, but I would imagine women were seen as second-class citizens, and that's what Casey describes.
Business today looks nothing like it did yesterday. While it's more unpredictable, its possibilities are endless. At ADP, turning unpredictability into an advantage is what we do. Using data-driven insights, we design HR solutions to help businesses work better, smarter, so they can think beyond today and find even more success tomorrow. HR, time, talent, benefits, payroll. ADP, always designing for people.
So But Jim Miller, I wanted to show you this clip from Saturday Night Live from their premiere episode. And I wanted to ask you about the place of satire and the tool that it can be or maybe not be. But anyway, let me share my screen.
All right.
And I'm going to show you the opening and then I'm going to cut to.
All right, America. Welcome to Send Something Normal. I'm your host, Halen Hardy. For those of you that don't know, the game is very simple. We have four male celebrity contestants. And all they have to do is reply to a woman's DM on Instagram in a way that is normal. And fellas, if you send a normal DM, you win $100 million. Again, the game is send a woman a normal DM and you win $100 million. Next up, coming to us all the way from his involuntary career change, Armie Hammer.
Yes, hi. Can I get a big welcome back to Hollywood round of applause?
No, you may not. And next
so I'm going to skip. So you have the setup, you know.
Right.
I'm going to skip forward to where I don't know why I keep harping on these text messages, but maybe it's because it's become such a joke. Here's
Armie Hammer, it's your turn to respond. Your message is, hey, Armie, hope you're doing okay.
All right, look, I know there's been a lot of talk about me in the press, but I've done a lot of work on myself, and I've changed. So I have my message.
What's it gonna be?
I want to break open your bones and suck out the marrow.
I'm not here to be a killjoy or a wet blanket. I think satire is incredibly important. It can expose, it can criticize. And certainly you could make the argument that without the Hannibal Burgess joke about Bill Cosby, which
kind of
decided that case. And I found myself laughing at this, but then immediately feeling shame because any of those of the alleged victims of Armie Hammer seeing that, you know, that joke about the text messages, how would they feel at being the butt of a joke, even though, you know, the joke is on him, but they're looped into it somehow. I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Just seeing that made me feel uncomfortable, but I did also think about how the entire focus on the Cosby case changed because of comedy, because somebody was being
brutally
satirical,
honest. Yeah.
Right. But yeah, but honest, this particular way of doing it, it just seems very the opposite of victim centric, right? It is, you know, sort of, you know, yeah, he's supposed to be the butt of that joke, but I don't know. It is in bad taste that, but you know, you're never gonna, I mean, Saturday Night Live,
which I love, and I'm
branded
not,
themselves with
yeah,
bad taste.
Yeah, of course.
You know, Jim's initial reaction, actually, I was just profiling Jim whilst he was saying what he did, and really, what your reaction was, Jim, was mine, which was.
Yeah,
you let out a lot of breath, whether you realized that you did that. But that to me was your real reaction of hearing it. And of course, we look to the positive in everything. We try and find a way to actually, in Cosby's case, it helped. But I agree, if it's the when we joke about women's experiences, and normally it's women who are the butt of these jokes, then it seems to be okay. And I don't like that. I think it kind of normalizes. And what does it bring to the table, really?
Right.
Maybe it does spotlight it, but it still kind of just makes it into something that's funny, and it's humor, and it's women being the butt of jokes. So I just don't like that when that happens, and it makes me exhale. And I think, you know, when we're at a time right now where women's reproductive rights have been taken away, where autonomy, where women are being devalued left and right, even more so, a lot of women would find that triggering. And therefore, I just don't think that it's okay. And the fact that it's men making those jokes again, will it happen to them? Probably unlikely. Is it women that these things tend to happen to, and that you get serial perpetration over and over again with lack of men being held accountable, and you get someone, we saw it with Weinstein, right? Oh, I'm a sex addict. I've gone into therapy for sex addiction. These crimes are not about sex addiction or just doing basic levels of work on yourself. This is about power and control issues that are severe, that have harmed probably many more women than we'll ever know about.
Right. And Why couldn't they have been smart enough to write humor where the women took back the power and he was being emasculated and he was being tortured? What?
Exactly.
You didn't find this funny? Oh, my God. How could you not find this funny? This is wonderful. You know, like, I'm having such a good time now because you're crawling. You've been raped and you're just crawling on your hands and knees trying to escape. That's funny. Yay. You know, if it could be, if the flip side of it is funny, why isn't that funny?
Right. Yeah. I need to read real quickly. Per Armie Hammer's lawyer, he has said all interactions between Mr. Hammer and his former partners were consensual. They were fully discussed, agreed upon in advance, and his partners, and mutually participatory. And the stories being perpetuated on social media are designed to be salacious and an effort to harm Mr. Hammer, but it doesn't make them true. I just felt like I needed
all right.
to.
All right. Thank you for saying that. But we should also say, I would like to add to that comment, that we are not being salacious here. We have no intention like that at all. And the fact is that the people who participated in those events said that they were not consenting. And even if they were, they may have been forced into it, coerced into it, coercively controlled into it. So that would not make what he did legitimate. It seems the lawyer is admitting, and by extension, Armie Hammer is admitting to doing the things that they said he was doing. So that doesn't protect him in my book. That doesn't make him a better person. It just says that he is trying to say that it's all okay. It's okay for him to do anything to a person who he feels he wants to do something to, whether they want it or not, whether they like it or not, whether they try to get him to stop. I mean, certainly him saying that he felt like God when he raped her and she was crawling away on her hands and knees begging for mercy. If he is admitting to the rape and he is admitting to the fact that she was trying to get away from him and trying to beg for mercy and crying, then to me, it seems like he's admitting to a crime. He may be denying it now, fine, but that doesn't mean he didn't already commit a crime.
Exactly,
we'll
Jim.
See. Yeah, we'll see when this gets to our court system.
His words are very damning, his own words. So I agree, just because he says it's consensual, well, my question would be, what steps did he take to ensure there was informed consent? And even when we know that someone's, you know, saying, well, it was consensual, she came up to the hotel room, she came there to meet me, etc. Well, we saw an image of a woman being tied up and left on a bed like an animal, and he walked straight past her. You know, when you're tied up, when you incapacitated, yes, you may well have consented to that, but anything that happens thereafter, you have no control over whatsoever. And even if you do have safe words being put in place, that doesn't mean to say that they're adhered to. But just because he says that there was consent, well, what steps did he take? Because the women are saying now it was not consensual, and that is an important narrative that I'm glad you corrected, Jim, that yes, we can say his little legal bit, but there are multiple women, not just one, saying the same thing that happened over and over again, that pattern of behavior. And I also just want to sort of flag, it was something off the back of what we were just discussing before that, which was to do with when someone says they're doing things in the right spirit, i.e. that they are portraying, you know, a docu-series, or they're doing something that's in the right spirit, to they're joking about it because it helps shine a light on things. Well, just because you say that, that doesn't necessarily make it true. And I'm thinking here about the Dharma documentary that's on Netflix that I refuse to watch. And it's Ryan Murphy's show. Just because he says that it's the victim POV, I'm afraid I don't buy that. And he can say all he wants that it's the POV of the victims and it's never been told before in this way. But why is it called Dharma then? Why isn't any victim centered?
In the title, it's twice.
Even in the title, yeah. Right? Where it's clear that it's about him and the trailer, the music, everything about it. And a lot of it is made up, is fictionalized. And the families are very unhappy about it. So just because you might say, oh, well, the joke is helpful because it spotlights, or the documentary is important, you know, if the families and the victims are saying something different, don't we owe it to them to listen to what they say? Don't we owe it to center them and to talk from their POV and their perspective and offer the counterbalance, which should be the far more important perspective, actually, in my opinion? So again, it's for all of us to look inwardly to ourselves for why is it that when someone comes forward, we look to scrutinize, we look to poke holes in it. We look from the POV that, oh, what did they do? Or why did they dress that way? Or why did they go to the hotel room? Why don't we come from the position of why did he do what he did? And did he try and get consent? And how did he manipulate this position or this situation or this person? How did he exploit the vulnerabilities? That's really where we should be coming from of the questions. And that's the questions you and I ask, Jim, when we're looking at a case and when we're hearing someone talk about abuse. And I can't still help but feel the reason why, particularly with women, we don't believe them is because of what we've been told about Adam and Eve, the bad act that Eve did. It's because what we were told about Pandora opening the box and Helen of Troy, who started the war. All these stories that are written about women, by whom? Who writes these stories about women? Where we're taught that we can't trust them, where they're not to be believed, where women are
manipulated. I think you forgot the Wizard of Oz that had at least two bad witches. And, you know, I mean, all the fairy tales, you know, with all these monstrous women.
I can't help but think, Jim and Lisa, though, that that does play a part because we've consumed it all of our lives, you know, and that's why every female perpetrator is a psychopath and cold-blooded killer and all of this stuff. It's just always the bias within us all that every time we have a case, there's this constant rush to poke holes in everything that a victim says, right. But yet pay no attention to the perpetrator, to the abuser. Right.
Also about that consciousness that the media kind of instills in people. I was talking to my assistant about Seinfeld, which is, it's been in the zeitgeist for 30, 40 years, at least 30 years, right? If you go back and look at some of those or a good portion of those episodes, it's always sort of the one episode interactions with his girlfriends, Jerry's girlfriends or George's girlfriends. They're extremely misogynistic, and that was just totally accepted. There was absolutely no, you know, pushback from anybody, you know, in standards and practices, in the community in general. They just, you know, kind of used women, you know, for entertainment, and that was it. And you know, there's no actual connection. It was very, very bad.
Yeah, but there are a lot of shows like that, Jim. When I watch them with my sons, you know, we tend to binge them. We binge Seinfeld. We do a binge Friends. And I'm always sort of side coaching, like, so we don't really think of women like this anymore, guys. You know, you kind of have to be.
Well, we never did think of them that way, but they were.
Well, somebody
that
did.
Way.
Somebody thought of them that
did.
Way.
Yeah, too. Definitely.
But one thing I wanted to ask you, Jim and Laura, that perhaps the victims coming forward about Armie Hammer, do you think they're only now realizing what consent is and what it isn't, that the absence of no is not the presence of yes? It seemed like Courtney was sort of, you know, her eyes were kind of open that I didn't say no, but I did not want this.
Informed consent is an important discussion, isn't it? And she says that she got carried along with everything. And bearing in mind, she was isolated, all the context of what went on.
Yeah, if you're manipulated into it, right.
Yeah.
If you're manipulated into consent or quasi-consent, then that is not actually informed consent. It's not voluntary consent. And so you have to look at that. If, you know, even the way he phrases, I want to share this with you. Well, that's not exactly what he's doing. No, what he's trying to do is slowly expose her to it so that it doesn't seem like it's such a bad thing. That's what he's actually doing. There is intention behind his actions and inactions. There is intention behind his introducing these women to his mother, behind his introducing them to particular activities or by breaking in them via words and exchanges so that he will maximize the chances that he will get quasi-consent. But as I said, it's not actual informed consent if somebody is being tricked into it, cajoled into it, coerced into it, manipulated into it.
Yeah. And if you're targeted, you know, we know with a lot of perpetrators and those who are very manipulative, not you, not you, not you, but you, they will check your compliance levels. They will check to get somebody who's malleable. They will expose. I still remember, you know, Armie Hammer or Courtney describing that they went to the desert and he took her into a shop, the DIY store with all the ropes, and he's exposing her to that. It's like the Epstein who's taking the girls up the staircase with all the naked pictures, this resetting of what's normal and possibly playing on, oh, it's your naivety, it's your sexual inexperience, you know, to make me happy, do X, Y, and Z. And we can't forget that girls and women are groomed on a macro level into that, that we should appease and we should be subordinate to our men and we should give them sexual pleasure. All these things that are handed down within how we're brought up, that we don't, no one ever communicates that to us fully, but they are the messages that a lot of girls and women have received. So I think we have to always think about, it's very easy to say, well, it was consensual. And I'll give you another example. Colleen Stan, who was abducted and kept in a box for 7 years and made to sign a contract that she agreed to become a slave to her master. He at court, when she was eventually rescued, ran the same line of defense. Well, this was consensual. That's how fantastical consent can be when you've got male lawyers, you've got the male extremely manipulated perpetrator who's saying that, well, we let her out every now and again, or he let her out. The wife did know about her being there. She didn't try and escape. Ergo, she consented to this. She wanted to be with us. It can be so distorted. But when you break it down of how did that relationship come about? How was she targeted? What were the words that were said to get her to ignore her concerns and regroom and get her back into that situation? We have to take the whole context and the lead up, and the fact that even the context that he's a relatively well-known actor, good-looking guy, that all plays into it. Seems to be successful from a successful family. Well, the women were also, it's a subjective thing, right? But they were good-looking, they were successful in their own rights. He was targeting girls and women who looked a certain way. So he can say that this was all consensual, but when you break it down, to me, it sounds like there was coercive control. And with coercive control, 99.9% of the time, there's sexual coercion. We have to assume that there's sexual coercion. That's what I see in all my cases. So I think it's very easy for people to say, well, I believed it was consensual. But you have to ask, well, what steps did you take to ensure there was informed consent?
Well, hopefully this is going to be a question for the Justice Department. Hopefully they are going to move forward and create a case against him. And then hopefully somebody like you, Laura, will be sitting in the witness stand testifying about coercive control, testifying about how consent can be manipulated and coerced, and hopefully a jury will make the right decision in a case like this. It's going to be tough because it is incredibly tough, as we've learned so many times, to actually prosecute a celebrity. Fortunately, it's happened with Cosby. It's happened with that other asshole who, you know, was manipulating women and coercively controlling them for decades. And just because he can sing, everybody was thinking he was bulletproof, including himself. Finally, he's gone down. So I just hate that women and men who are victimized in this way have to go through all of that. And it can't just be once they have gone through it that they can't feel secure in coming forward, that they're going to be believed, and that the justice system is going to take it seriously enough to do something immediately rather than waiting sometimes multiple decades.
Yes, I hope so too, Jim, because oftentimes we don't see experts being used to testify in these cases, or maybe the wrong experts. And we talked about sure we're thinking of the same.
Or non-expert people. Yeah.
Non-expert, yeah, who's there to work for the defense. And I say work intentionally to cast a light on the victims and to discredit them. It's very easy to discredit somebody, but that doesn't mean to say that just because X might be true, that it means that they're lying. And that is something I get very angry about, that we're being led to believe that victims make this stuff up. I mean, there is no gain. Even with a celebrity, there is no gain. We see the way that victims are treated within the criminal justice system and how others in the court of public opinion can treat victims too. We started talking about that with Kim Goldman, but we've talked about it many times. And so there is no real gain for those who think, oh, well, they've come out now because they're jumping on the bandwagon, which of course is what we hear oftentimes when you have multiple women who come forward. But I do think oftentimes women have been abused multiple times in life, and oftentimes they just stay quiet because they are fearful, and fearful for lots of reasons, fearful of repercussions from the perpetrator, but also fearful of the criminal justice system because they see how women and victims are treated. And we're still not there yet of leveling the playing field and ensuring that victims and survivors have the right support. But it's a lifetime of work, isn't it, to continue that healing journey. And you can be secondary victimized and traumatized by professionals and others within the system who, you know, get it wrong and are not trauma informed. And most professionals, and I'll say this, are not trauma informed. That's why you've got four officers at the Gabby Petito call out who don't understand trauma, who sit her in the back of the police car where you'd put a suspect. They spend 80% of their time with Brian, and they don't understand Gabby's trauma and the fact she's terrified she's going to be left alone there. And all his behavior, all his actions show that he is goading her, provoking her, saying that he's going to leave her. Two witnesses saw it. That's what they report. And yet four of those officers all gravitate to Brian, who's calm, cool, bumping fists, and they don't see Gabby's trauma. So yes, we've discussed many difficult, uncomfortable, upsetting, triggering themes, I think, for many of our listeners. And what I will say to our listeners, if you've been victimized, it's not your fault. You're not to blame. You're not alone. I think that's another really important point. There are trained professionals who can help and who will help. And it is a, you know, they're difficult subjects for us all to talk about, but we have to keep talking about them. We have to keep identifying and spotlighting abuse and those who are the abusers. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
Real Crime Profile was created by Jim Clementi, Laura Richards, and Lisa Zambetti. Produced by Laura Richards, Lisa Zambetti, Jim Clementi, and XG Productions, and distributed by Wondery. Editing by Nick Jaworski at Podcast Monster. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba.